There's another exhibit associated with Prove It, but one which, if all goes well in December, will, unlike Prove It, become an exhibit that the Science Museum will hold in perpetuity. Now, Professor Miles Allen, head of the Climate Dynamics Group at Oxford University, had the idea. He's with us this morning. And he pointed out in a recent scientific publication that during the last year, unheeded and without ceremony, humanity burned the half-trillionth ton of coal, oil, or gas. We don't know which. On Miles's suggestion, we've acquired a ton of coal, which we've designated the trillionth ton. The significance of this is that to avoid dangerous climate change, and even the smallest possibility of a 4-degree centigrade global temperature rise, we must never release to the atmosphere the carbon dioxide from that trillionth ton. So if Copenhagen fulfills its historic purpose, the museum will hold this ton forever, DCMS supporting us, of course, symbolising for future generations that success. On the other hand, if the outcome were not successful, at the appropriate moment, which could be as soon as 2050, our successors here at the museum will ceremoniously take the ton to a power station and burn it. So, ministers, the legacy of your efforts and of all the negotiators at Copenhagen will be graphically symbolised here at the Science Museum, which we call for good reason and with great hope, the Museum of the Future. With that, it's my pleasure to introduce the Chief Scientific Advisor to the Government, Professor John Beddington. John.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you, William. Secretaries of State, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I'm John Beddington. I've got the task of, in 10 minutes, explaining to you the future of the world. I'll try to make somewhat more than 10 points in that time, so I'm going to talk relatively quickly. Please forgive me. That's me. We can move on from that. The first message here is that the acceptance by the G8, the acceptance by the major economic fora that 2 degrees was the target for the future is enormously important. It doesn't mean to say that there is no problem. 2 degrees is going to be problematic. There are going to be a need to adapt to the climate changes that will be driven by a 2-degree rise. But having that target is enormously important because 4 degrees is disastrous. Under 4 degrees, and I'll go into a little more detail later on, the 16% potential increase in the Arctic with corresponding changes, a substantial impact on crops at a time when we know that the rising human population, the changes of urbanisation and the changes of wealth mean that we've got to actually increase the production of crops in a substantial way. We also have massive problems of water scarcity already, and the sort of problems that are coming from 4 degrees are going to take us into the additional billion people with major water scarcity. Moving on, you've seen the map, and unless you have extraordinarily good eyesight, rather better than mine, you will not be able to see it on these screens. You have it in your place, and I'm going to, later on, try to enlarge some of these sections to take it through. But first of all, I want to emphasize on the science. The first thing is, we have an enormous, worldly successful, world-class scientific center in the Hadley Group. It is undeniably world-class and probably the most influential group of scientists in the world influencing the debate on climate change. They've developed an interesting technique. I'll go through it very briefly, but the thing I would emphasize is that the techniques have been peer-reviewed by international teams. This is not speculative science, or at least such speculation that's coming out of it has been properly assessed by some of the best scientific brains in the world. The Hadley Center is terrific. What they've done is that they've looked at a whole series of possible global models. What those models show is that perhaps as early as 2060, we might have a 4-degree rise in temperature worldwide. It might be as late as 2100, and indeed of all the models they looked at, only one indicated 4 degrees was reached a little bit after 2100. So what we're looking at is not in the pictures that follow, what we're not looking at is a particular date. It's somewhere likely to be, if we're not successful at Copenhagen, between 2060 and 2100. But we're looking at a 4-degree world. And the problems of that 4-degree world, I'm now going to take you through quite quickly. The first problem is the fact that 4 degrees is an average for the world, including the world oceans. And if you look at the banding here, you see that taking the Arctic over the land, that the sort of changes in temperature can be will be between 8 and 16 degrees. Remember, this is an average. That water, the temperature for the world average includes the oceans. The slides here showing 8 to 16 degree rises in the Arctic, 5 to 7 in the temperate latitudes, 3 to 8 in the tropics, and 4 to 8 in the Antarctic show the distribution and the changes that will actually occur. So 4 degrees is a world average, but it's going to be an awful lot hotter in some of these zones, and that's really an important issue to point out. What I've done subsequently is to disaggregate. Looking at Europe, and I hope you can see this map a little bit better, we're going to have in Europe high forest fire danger, a 70% reduction in water flow, particularly in the Mediterranean area, sea level rises and storm surges, which will affect our coasts throughout Europe. We're going to see significant problems of drought in the Mediterranean, and the hottest days of the year across Europe are going to be up to 8 degrees warmer. And to give you an idea of that, Athens reached a maximum of 43 degrees. Typically, the maximum temperature could then be in excess of 50, which is just about unbearable, having been in it one time myself. Moving on from Europe into Southeast Asia, I focused on food and I focused on population. Major increases in world population are going to come in Southeast Asia. And if you see what we can expect if we have 4 degrees, is that maize and wheat yields reduced by 40%, rice yields down by 30%, big problems in sea level rises, enormously important in Southeast Asia because many of the major conurbations are being developed on the mega deltas. So enormous problems of potential displacement of people. The Himalayan glaciers are going to be seriously reduced, and there's going to be serious droughts far more frequently. So Southeast Asia, enormous problems here. Moving on to the Americas. First of all, very big increase in the danger of forest fires. Again, big reductions in parts of a 70% reduction in river and stream flow, particularly in South America. Disappearance of many of the glaciers that currently exist in South America. Tropical cyclones will increase their destructive power, and the hottest days up to 10 degrees to 12 degrees for eastern North America. And to give you an idea of that, the hottest day in New York typically is about 39 degrees, so that would take New York up to somewhere in the region of 50 degrees on the hottest day. Again, largely unbearable. And moving on and taking to Africa. And we've seen and heard this morning about the tragic drought and the effect that's actually having on the Ethiopian people as we see a reemergence of the problems that were there some 20 or 30 years ago, and we've moved on. Big dangers of forest fires, but focusing on food, potential yield reductions of 40% in maize and wheat, staples for the African economy, and Africa is set to double its population by 2050. This is enormously problematic. Droughts will be twice as frequent in southern Africa, and the hottest days, particularly on the Mediterranean coast, are going to be similar, although Algiers will be somewhat warmer than Athens. The last slide takes you to the map, but I just want to finger and point to some of the key issues. There's going to be sea level rise. Water scarcity and drought will be throughout the world in many places causing enormous problems and if it happens, significant problems of international migration and to avoid climate change and the consequent problems of drought, food shortage and water shortage. There's going to be a danger of tipping point. Sorry, that's a technical term, but it's sudden and dramatic and unexpected change. And one of the areas where there is a real potential for this is in the melting of the tundra. If we get to 4 degrees, we might expect the tundra to melt. The rotting of the vegetation will generate more methane, and this will add yet more and fuel the actual climate change increases by putting more greenhouse gases up into the atmosphere. Ocean acidification, not time to talk about it. Dramatic problem anyway. The oceans are as acid as they've been for 25 million years. If this happens, they'll be as acid as they've been for 400 million years. Food productivity, I've already spoken about. Ice melt will mean that the reserves that are stored in glaciers are not going to be there, and risks to large areas of the Amazon forest. Tropical cyclones more intense. What more can I say? This is disastrous if it happens. We've got to meet that 2-degree target. It won't be easy, but we've got to do it. So with pleasure, I now pass over to the people who are charged with doing it. I just have to pose the problems. They have to solve them.
Thank you very much, John, for that fantastically clear presentation. Thank you very much to the Science Museum for combining their efforts with ours for today's launch. We haven't been able to find in the Foreign Office records an example of a Foreign Secretary speaking at the Science Museum, and certainly not one who got a D in A-level physics. So we're not planning to make a habit of it. But I do think that this is the place to discuss what Al Gore, in the strapline for his film An Inconvenient Truth, described as a planetary emergency, but which, in fact, John Bennington's presentation shows Al Gore got wrong. It's not a planetary emergency, it's a human emergency. And this is about the lives of hundreds of millions of people around the world. The reason for publishing this map nearly 50 days before the Copenhagen conference is very simple. For too many people, not just in our own country, but around the world, the penny hasn't yet dropped. The penny hasn't dropped that this climate change challenge is real and it's happening now. The penny hasn't dropped that the effects are not into some far-flung future, but will actually be affecting hundreds of millions of people, certainly within my lifetime, and these sort of changes, the 4-degree changes, within my children's lifetime. The penny hasn't dropped, too, that Copenhagen is the chance to address, on a global scale, the climate change challenge and the mitigation of it and the adaptation to it. There isn't yet that sense of urgency and drive and animation about the Copenhagen conference. And the work that the Prime Minister has been leading, he spoke at a major conference on Monday that Ed was chairing of the major emitters. The work that's being done around Europe and certainly some of the discussions internationally are trying to make sure that the importance of the next 50 days are properly understood. I just want to reflect today on three foreign policy aspects of the presentation that you've seen and of the agenda that we face. For some time, I think it's been clear that climate change is not actually an environmental issue. It's an economic issue, it's a cultural issue, it's a technological issue, and after the presentation by 11 retired American generals 3 years ago, people began to think of it as a foreign policy issue. And so the first thing I want to bring to the surface today, or highlight, is three aspects of the map that you can see and that which you can study rather more carefully. The first is the dangers of water shortage. If you think about the sources of insecurity around the world, water shortage must be one of the greatest. The figures that John's presented, and you probably can't see all of the details here, but the figures that show that the number of people suffering from severe water shortages will rise under a 4-degree world eightfold to around 4 billion. Increased drought and desertification is greatly going to reduce the available food, too, for a rising population. So you've got a scissors effect there of quite dramatic proportions. Secondly, and there are obvious foreign policy consequences of that, secondly is the dangers of mass migration. We already see the tensions around the world of some 200 million people on the move. The figures that you can extrapolate from this work suggest that there will be further unprecedented mass migration of some further 150 to 200 million people on the move. The Maldives example is the most obvious. The Maldive cabinet had their underwater meeting to show what the Maldives' future is going to be under the water level rises that you've seen. But you just have to think of Bangladesh, a country which faces 25 to 40% of its landmass being covered in water in the course of this century without mitigation and adaptation of a fundamental kind. And thirdly, the dangers of increased pressure and conflict. One of the most dangerous parts of the world is obviously the Middle East. 5% of the world's population live in the Middle East. They have access to 1% of the world's water. Those sort of strains and stresses can only be exacerbated by the trends that we've seen here. And when we had our first press conference in this series in early September, I made the point that the UN Security Council very rarely discussed climate change. at the moment. The UN Security Council is dedicated to addressing issues of the threats to international peace and security. If you think about the issues that I've just raised in terms of security, migration, and conflict, you can see that a 4 degrees world is one in which the UN Security Council is going to be dominated by questions related to climate change. The second foreign policy aspect I just want to touch on is the multilateral challenge that is faced by the negotiators at Copenhagen, led in our case by Ed, and with him the rest of our European Union colleagues representing a common position. This is, I think, probably the most complex international negotiations ever attempted, because it's obviously about economics, but it's also about technology, and as the Prime Minister explained on Monday, it's significantly about finance as well. And I think it's very important not to underestimate the scale of the challenge to the multilateral system. But the point I want to make is that if the multilateral system is unable to address an issue like climate change, then people around the world are going to say that the multilateral system isn't worth its name. And that is very dangerous for those of us who believe that in a world of international interdependence, we need a stronger and more effective multilateral system. So the test in December is not just a climate change test. It's a test of our ability to rise to a challenge that is widely recognized to be a defining one for our generation. The third foreign policy point I'd just like to make is to reflect on the question of whether or not a foreign policy needs to be ethical, in other words, if it needs to be values-based. And in all the talk of the science and the technology that underpins the publication today, I think it's very important not to lose the importance of values. Because if you look hard at the map, what you will see is that the poorest people in the poorest countries are most exposed to the dangers of climate change. Not just because they can least afford the adaptation that's necessary, but also because they are exposed to its greatest effects. But there's also a flip side of the coin. If there is to be an international agreement, it needs to be based on very clear values. The first value is that the greatest burden must be borne by those who have the greatest capacity to meet it. In other words, richest countries have to do the most. And so the social justice principle is essential if there is to be a climate change deal. The second value is the value of mutual responsibility. In 1992, the Rio conference agreed the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities. In other words, it's not just true that the richest have to do the most, everyone has to do something. And that is a very, very important principle in an interdependent world. And the third and final point I want to make, the third and final value, is the value of internationalism. This negotiation will only succeed if it is a genuinely global agreement. Because the Kyoto Protocol was pioneering in many, many ways. Our country has shown that you can combine economic growth with meeting your environmental and climate change commitments, but it wasn't a global treaty of the sort that we need. And that's why I think the principle of internationalism, the value of internationalism, is at stake in the negotiations ahead. On that note, I'm delighted to hand over to our chief climate change negotiator, Ed Miliband. Thank you.
David, thank you, and thank you to Chris. And it's fantastic to be here at the Science Museum, where I came often as a kid, and it's a fantastic and illuminating place, and I think it's brilliant that you've taken up the challenge of, in this year of all years, talking about climate change and the impact of climate change. I just want to make three points. One, about the challenge of persuading people about the issue of climate change. The second, about something about the challenge of Copenhagen itself and the agreement that we are seeking. And the third, just something about politics and the role of politics and the role of science. First, on the challenge of persuasion, I think what I've learned during the time that I've been doing this job is that while we often think about climate change as a distant and future prospect, the truth is that for millions of people around the world, it is a current reality. So David mentioned Bangladesh. I had the chance to go to Bangladesh a couple of months ago and visit some of the people who are living on the sandbanks there in Bangladesh. They showed me what happened in the 2007 floods. The cyclones are becoming more frequent, the flooding is becoming more frequent, and they literally, in this encampment, saw all but four of their homes washed away. And there are 2 million people living in those circumstances in Bangladesh. So this isn't just a prospect that will affect our kids, it is something that is affecting people now. But related to that, I think one of the arguments that we still need to land with people is the idea that this is not just going to affect people in Bangladesh, it's going to affect people in Britain as well. I was looking at some figures recently saying that only 18% of people think that it will affect their children, that climate change will affect their children. And therefore, there is a huge mountain to climb in explaining the impacts, and this is why the four-degree map is important. So that is, if you like, the nightmare that we must seek to avoid and the present-day problems that we must seek to deal with. But there is another half to this story that we need to tell, and that is the positive story. Because the nightmare of dangerous climate change is a terrible problem and will be a terrible problem for future generations. But you also have to present people with a positive vision. And the truth is that we do have a positive vision. Because if you think about this Copenhagen Agreement, if the world can make the low-carbon transition, if the world can make a decisive break towards low-carbon, it will unleash trillions of dollars of economic opportunity around the world. In Britain, we are already starting to see this. We're developing in the northeast of England the largest offshore wind blade in the world. We've got plans for carbon capture and storage, for being part of the nuclear renaissance that is going on around the world. All of these things will offer jobs not just to people in Britain, but people around the world. And therefore, I think that we can confidently say that a Copenhagen Agreement won't just be good for our environment, but it'll be good for our economy as well, and it will be good for energy security. Because what we know is that if you look ahead, China and India, other emerging economies, are seeing greater demand for gas and for oil. That will drive up prices. Therefore, the secure energy choice is also the low-carbon choice, not just for Britain, but for other countries as well. And I think that part of our task as politicians is to get across the dangers that we must seek to avoid, but the positive vision that is part of tackling climate change. That's the first point I want to make. The second point is just briefly, and David's referred to it, about the agreement we are seeking itself. I think that there is a danger in this Copenhagen process that people make it complex. In one sense, it is fantastically complex. 189 countries from around the world, a whole multiplicity of issues, legal articles and protocols and all that. But in a sense, it's quite simple. What is the world trying to do? It is trying to do what it has never done before, which is to turn around the inexorable rise in global carbon emissions. If we can come out of Copenhagen with a path that shows that emissions for the world will start to fall, not rise, then we will be on track to limiting dangerous climate change to 2 degrees and avoiding the 4-degree world that John Beddington talked about. That is the central task of Copenhagen. And I think it's important to say that while it is a very tough ask, because the world has never done it before, we didn't do it at Kyoto, there are reasons for hope in this. Because the deadline is concentrating minds. In the last month alone, we have seen the president of China go to the UN and announce a change in Chinese domestic policy, saying that they will measure and cut their carbon intensity. We've seen a new government in Japan say they will cut their emissions by 25% by 2020. We have seen proposals from Indonesia, from India, from Brazil around what they will do as part of a Copenhagen Agreement. Now, I don't think this thing is a done deal at all. Far from it. We could fail at Copenhagen. Absolutely we could. But I think there are also reasons for hope, and I think it's important to say that. So we need to turn around the rise in the inexorable rise in carbon emissions, and we need to finance a global deal on the principles that David had set out. And I think people in rich countries, at a time when our economies are facing difficulties, again, we need to make the case for why finance is so important. And the reason is simple. We bear the historic responsibility for what has happened, we in the developed world, for what has happened so far in terms of climate change. But if we are to have any chance of tackling the problem, we need the developing world to come with us. And to persuade countries where there are hundreds of millions of people in poverty, finance needs to be part of the deal. So that's the second point I want to make. I think that Copenhagen is a complex process. It is an uphill struggle to get a deal. In my view, it is doable. And I think it's essentially doable if we concentrate, keep our eyes on the prize and concentrate on what really matters. The final point I just want to make is about science and about politics. I think it is the job of scientists in this process to interpret what may happen, and I think the role of science is fundamentally important. But it is also the job of politics to change things, and I think that the danger we have in this, one of the dangers, is a danger of defeatism. The danger that people think nothing can change. I think it was Robert Kennedy who said that the biggest danger you face in politics was the danger of futility. The idea that one man or one woman couldn't do anything about the enormous array of the world's ills. Now, I think it is really important in this climate change debate that we make clear to people that we can turn things around and we can change things. And we have many of the technologies that we need. If we put the finance forward, I also believe there is a political will around the world to do it. The final ingredient is the public, and David is completely right about this. The involvement of the public in this process is so important. We cannot let Copenhagen just pass people by. My biggest worry has always been that this would be just like any other summit. It would come and go, it would be an item on Newsnight, and people wouldn't worry about it. It needs to be more than that. That is why not just myself, the Prime Minister, David, will be making the case here and around the world in the coming weeks. I think we can get a deal that prevents dangerous climate change. It requires imagination. It requires leadership. But I think it's doable. Thank you very much.
Foreign Secretary, Secretary of State Fedek, thank you very much for that very thought-provoking presentation. There is now an opportunity for questions and answers. We have two roving mics. Well, we certainly have one, I can see. There's quite a crowd here. I can see hands going up already. We'll start by taking one question at a time. There's one over here, Andrew, just this gentleman with the brown jacket on. And if you could identify yourself and the... people will, I'm sure, be very happy if you can be very brief with your question.
Hi.
Yeah, it is on, I think.
Jason Priestley from TBS Japan. Given that Copenhagen, the decisions are going to be made by the politicians, the current government campaign, public awareness, which includes a television advertisement, which has created a bit of a fuss, is this perhaps a sign that you're fearful of a possible public backlash when people start having to make sacrifices and paying for the commitments that you're hoping to make in Copenhagen?
Who would like to take that?
I'm happy to answer.
Okay. Yes.
Look, I think our campaign is very important, the Act on CO2 campaign, and I'm glad it's getting attention because it has a very clear purpose in mind. I mentioned earlier that only 18% of people think that their kids will be affected by dangerous climate change. We have a responsibility to warn people of the dangers. It would be irresponsible for us not to be doing this advert, in my view, and irresponsible for us not to be doing what we're doing today, because knowing what we know and knowing what the scientists are telling us about the dangers, I think it is fundamental to what government needs to do as part of public information to warn people, essentially. And if the Act on CO2 advert impels people to make changes in their own lives, to be part of public campaigns, to become more aware of the problem, then I think it's absolutely, it will have done its purpose. Important to say in this, we're trying to do something which I don't think has ever happened across the world on any political issue, which is build a consensus which spans political parties, which spans developed and developing countries, and lasts. And that's a very big task, and I think that's why it's right to get the information out there.
Thank you. Next question. This gentleman here. And I'll use this microphone to stop the Secretary of State.
Thank you. Stuart Burgess. I chair the Commissioner for Rural Communities. Obviously, climate change is on a macro and a micro level. And I just want to ask a question. I've been actually very impressed with Ashton Hayes, a village in Cheshire, which is trying to become the first carbon neutral village in England. And I think that Ed is absolutely right, but the key question is how do we actually convince the population that climate change, A, is important, and embed it, as Ashton Hayes has done, within the children's education in a primary school that has taken this on. How do we embed it in children's education, which I think is the key for the future?
That sounds like a question to me, which is a bit of a surprise, but I'm happy to say something on behalf of the Science Museum. What we know is that what you might call the evidence deficit is not sufficient. That is, you can give somebody a packet with smoking kills on it and they'll still light up a cigarette. So the Science Museum is looking at a variety of ways of engaging people in the debate. And what we find is that when you have a two-way dialogue, which is quite difficult to do with 3 million visitors, but when you do have a two-way dialogue, people begin to take this much more seriously. I think that the educational system is doing a great job, actually. I think there is a lot of discussion in the formal curriculum about climate change. Indeed, one of the problems is that kids know so much about it that by their mid-teens they begin to become tired of the subject. So the museum certainly tries to engage people in the debate, which is what this exhibit is about and what our exhibit will be next year.
I just want to make a point about the global negotiations, because the truth is that not just in this country, but in other countries too, there's going to have to be strong acts of leadership. And I think one of the most significant things that's happening is that while environment ministers have been engaged on this issue for many years, foreign ministers have got interested over the last few years, this is now being taken up at the level of leaders of countries, heads of government. And I think that is the significance of the Prime Minister's proposals on climate finance. It's the significance of President Obama's interest in this issue. It's the significance of President Hu's contribution to the UN special session on climate change. And I think that what we have to understand, that in the end, it's going to be a relatively small number of decisions, never mind decision makers, that hold the key to whether or not the leadership comes together and the world is spurred on or not. And those issues are going to come down to a fundamental question, which is whether all of the political leaders believe that they're willing to take on the potential burden, the potential flak from attacks within their own countries that say we can't afford this. That's going to be the essential question that's in the mind of every leader, whether they can afford it in terms of their own economic trajectory, whether they can afford it financially. And that is a quintessentially political decision, and it's one that requires a perspective over a long term, not just the short term. The power of the sort of examples that you cite, which exist in the developing world as well as in the developed world, which exist in China and India in terms of renewable energy and other issues, as well as in the UK in terms of zero carbon housing and communities, is that they show it's possible. They break the naysayers who exist in every country and say, look, we can't afford to do this, because they show that you can actually afford to do this. And so in a way, what we've got to do is make sure that the sort of commitments that have been made in this country to 2050 for an 80% reduction in emissions on 1990 levels, they're matched in other countries. We've got to hold the line in Europe, and I think it's important to say to people here that the General Affairs Council on Monday and then the European Council on Friday will be discussing climate financing. And Europe has to hold the line. It's established itself as a global leader, but my goodness, now is not the time to relax or to relent. We've got to stay on the front foot. All of the rich countries have got to do enough to show the developing world that they're serious, and that is, I think, the importance, not just of the Japanese step forward, but also the Australian commitments. And then the developing countries have got to show that they're able to step up as well. In a way that is proportionate and appropriate to the burden that they should bear. And that is the political two-step or three-step that needs to take place. And I think we shouldn't lose sight of that in the discussion of the local examples. We should use the local examples to spur on the big political step.
Very good. There's a disembodied hand that was waving at the back and has got the microphone.
Hi, Jeff Hardy, UK Energy Research Centre. It's a question about the emphasis that we place on climate change and also the legacy that if we do something about climate change will result in. I would like to see more positive advertising about the energy system, the low-carbon secure society that will be a legacy of a Copenhagen agreement both in the UK and elsewhere. It's a really positive picture, and it's something that scientists and engineers and many other disciplines can get excited about. So I'd like to see that in advertising, and I'd certainly like to see that perhaps in the Science Museum's exhibition forthcoming.
Okay, I'll have a word with our advertisers. I agree with you about this, actually. It was it came home to me when a Labour Party member said to me, Martin Luther King didn't say, I have a nightmare. He said, I have a dream. I think both of these aspects are important in truth. We have to warn people of the dangers because I think that there isn't, as I said, sufficient awareness of the dangers, and we've got to make clear the benefits and the potential benefits. And it's not just, and I think you make a really important point, it's not just for one country that these benefits accrue, because what is one of the things that is holding back low-carbon investment at the moment? Frankly, it's uncertainty. It's uncertainty about the carbon price, and it's uncertainty about whether the world is going to make this this move to low carbon. That's why an agreement is so important. But I agree with you that to persuade people and to bring people with us, we also have to present the positive vision. As I say, that's something I've learned very strongly in the last year that I've been doing this job, and it's something I try and emphasise because I think it is important.
Thank you very much. There's a question from a gentleman over here. There we go. Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm the High Commissioner of Bangladesh. And being a physicist myself, I can well understand the reasons for the warm global warming and the disaster we are facing for that reasons. I thank both the ministers, both the brothers, for mentioning the consequences Bangladesh would face if something is not done in the Copenhagen conference, because you know the reasons we are making noises everywhere. We need to do it because we do not have any other alternatives for our survivals. We are doing it for our survivals. As Ed Miliband correctly mentioned, that at least 30 to 40% of the land would go underwater if something is not done by the world community. So it's my appeal to the world community to do something for the protection of the affected people around the world. So it should be an integrated effort by all the community leaders. And I appreciate the stance taken by the British government in this regard. And I hope something would come out in the Copenhagen conference which would save the millions of people around the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll just briefly respond to that contribution because I think it's very important and I'm very grateful to you for being here. I think the other thing which I didn't get a chance to say is this, that actually we can make a huge difference to people, for example, in Bangladesh, in terms of adapting to climate change in the short term with relatively small amounts of money. I saw a DFID program which was raising up the level at which people lived physically to protect them from the floods. Now, that is not a long-term solution, but it is a short-term way in which we need to adapt to climate change, and Bangladesh needs to adapt to climate change, and it can literally save millions of lives. And that's why it's so important, as part of a Copenhagen agreement, that we have money for adaptation to climate change for developing countries, as well as money to help them cut their carbon emissions.
David, did you want to add anything to that?
No.
Okay. There's a question in the middle here, and then a lady in front.
Thank you. Stephen Weir from Catalyst Group. My question is probably to Ed Miliband. Thank you very much to both of you for your hard work on behalf of the global community. You mentioned leadership and courage and strength. My community in Hereford has a climate action group. Every third Saturday we meet, we march around town, we try and get engagement. What advice would you give us and what wish would you have from the UK and wider communities for leaders to step up and join you on this? How do you see local leadership supporting your global leadership?
Well, look, I mean, I think local leadership is incredibly important in this, and I think mobilisation around these issues really matters. I had the chance to go to the Transition Towns annual conference where I was a keynote listener rather than a keynote speaker, which is a good experience for politicians to have. And there is fantastic work being done all around this country. And again, you know, this is not just going to happen with political leaders doing the right things, important though that is. It's got to be people who persuade other people in their communities to take this seriously. and who show what can happen. I think the other thing that interests me about this is it's not just a way of tackling climate change. I don't know whether you found this in Hereford, but it brings people together and gets people to know their neighbours and come together and form friendships with people in ways they couldn't have expected. And so in a sense, that is the positive power that the cause can provide, I think.
Thank you. The lady here, and then a gentleman over here.
My name is Sachi Glaring-Bolt for the Tokyo Chunichi newspapers.
Sorry, could you hold the microphone a bit closer?
Yes. I have a question with regard to the United States, because obviously we have heard of the commitments of China, Japan, and other countries, but the Kyoto Protocol was finally not ratified by the United States, and this time their leadership is very much necessary. How do you expect their commitment will be, and do you think that this time they will commit?
Well, obviously, the arrival of a new administration with a strong set of campaign commitments in this area is very significant. I think that the engagement of leading senators on this issue is obviously important, because it was Congress which didn't pass the Kyoto Protocol after the signature by the Clinton administration. And I think we've got to recognize that the administration came in on January the 20th, so the UN process had been going for quite a long time by the time they came into play. But I think that the way we in the UK have framed this, that we need a deal which is ambitious, fair, and effective, is something that can speak to the United States. Ambitious for obvious reasons that have been explained by the science, fair because everyone has to make a contribution, and effective, which I think is something that's been of concern, to make sure that the finance flows and other mechanisms actually go to the right place and in the right way. And certainly I know that Mrs. Clinton is thinking about the foreign policy aspects of this in a very substantial way. She's rethinking the way American aid and other engagement works. And I think that the climate change challenge fits in very well to the reconception of America's role in the world that the president has been so clear about.
Ed, did you want to add anything? Okay, John. It is on.
Okay, I'd probably add to that because I think that the Obama administration has shown an enormous commitment to proper science. They've appointed Stephen Chu, the Nobel laureate in physics, to run the Department of Energy, increased enormously the budget of the Department of Energy, focused almost entirely on the low carbon energy input. So I think that there is actual inward investment, and the Obama regime is recognizing it. They have, as my equivalent in Washington, John Holdren, a longtime campaigner for the issue of climate change and its importance. So I think that there is an internal commitment within that regime, which is showing both in investment, but also in the sort of appointments they've been making at the highest level.
Thank you, John. Now, we have a question coming here. Time is beginning to run short. I should just introduce, and I regret not having done so before, Dr. Vicky Pope, who's head of climate prediction at the Met Office Hadley Centre. So if there are any specific questions about the modelling and the four-degree map, I'm sure Vicky would be happy to respond to those. But now let's just take the question from over here. And can you indicate, there's one over here. Okay, one more. All right.
Hello, Jason Beattie from the Daily Mirror. Can I ask, first of all, Professor Beddington to spell out in more detail what climate change would mean for mainland Britain? And can I ask the Foreign Secretary if you could flesh out what you mean in terms of the consequences of conflict and mass migration for the UK? Are we going to have to open our borders up to more people? Are armed forces going to be engaged in more warfare in the next 50 years?
Thank you.
In terms of the what is likely for the UK economy, earlier on in this year, DEFRA published some analysis done using exactly the same techniques by the Hadley Centre to look at what the effects are on the UK economy. There are a lot of them, but broadly speaking, I think we can have an expectation of some serious problems in the south of England in the summer in terms of shortage of water. I think we can also expect that the frequency of very high temperatures is going to increase substantially. So, and the high temperature that we saw in 2003 resulted in a large number of deaths. I think that those are just two, but the document is is available with DEFRA and has a lot of more detail, and I can't go into it here.
Jason, I think that the way to describe it is that this would be a high-pressure world. High pressure on migration, high pressure from conflict. The decisions of a UK government in respect to those issues are obviously something for long in the future. But given the scope of our global interests and our global commitments, that high pressure on the UK can only lead to cost for the UK, not just cost in a narrow financial sense, obviously. But I think that the purpose of the map is to dramatise the nature of the pressures that will exist on the foreign policy front as well as on the domestic front, and I think they come through very clearly. One thing I meant to say in my introduction is that I think these are very alarming findings, but they are not alarmist. They've been done by 27 of the world's leading scientific organisations with an incredible degree of scientific rigour. And I think that people should recognise that they are alarming, but this is not a piece of alarmism. It's not just a piece of dramatics or TV fiction. It's actually really scientifically based, and that's why I think the high pressure that would be on countries like the UK and our global interests is so important to explain.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm getting signals that we should now draw this session to a close. So it's my pleasure to thank the Foreign Secretary, David Miliband, Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change, Ed Miliband, for having come here this morning, John Beddington and Vicky Pope also. It is our objective at the Science Museum to become the destination for the public engagement in this hugely important topic. And I think that we should wish our negotiators well to come up with a settlement which will serve our interests and the interests of future generations. So thank you for coming. Thank you to everybody for participating.